disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Fueled by fantasies of committing the perfect murder, two individuals would carve their name into infamy and rock the island of Great Britain throughout the 1960s with the torture, rape, and murder of five children. For decades, they would be, and some still consider them to be, the most heinous criminals in UK history. Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, collectively known as the Moors Murderers, would permanently change the British zeitgeist. Tonight, we take a look at those murders and the perpetrators behind them. If you find our show interesting and you'd like to support us, please consider heading over to patreon.com/deadsouls and donating to our research and investigations. If Instagram is more your thing, you can find us there by searching Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. Now that we are back on a weekly broadcasting schedule, we wanted to also let you know about the true crime series that we will be putting out. Titled Notorious, once a month we will drop a deep dive true crime episode amongst our usual episodes. Tonight is the first of those true crime episodes. We hope that you find them interesting. This is Notorious Episode 1, The Moors Murders. Wicked lovers Ian Brady and Myra Hindley lured children and teenagers to their deaths, then buried them on the bleak Saddleworth Moor, near Manchester in the South Pennine mountain range. Even now, almost 60 years since their spree of depravity horrified a nation, many still consider the pair evil personified. At age just 18, Myra Hindley took a job with a wholesale chemical company named Millwood's Merchandising. It was January of 1961. Hindley had no idea how her life would soon change. Hindley quickly fell in love with a co-worker, a senior stock clerk named Ian Brady. Brady and Myra Hindley became two of the most well-known and vicious serial killers in British history, but the deaths of both of the killers left behind a multitude of unanswered questions. Who really were Ian Brady and Myra Hindley? What drove them to kill the five children that they did? Let's take a look at the documents and evidence that may give us some insight. Ian Brady was born Ian Duncan Stewart in January 1938 in Glasgow, Scotland. Brady's mother, Margaret Peggy Stewart, was a waitress in a small Glasgow tea room who had her son out of wedlock. She would claim that Brady's father was a newspaper reporter who passed away 3 months prior to his son's birth, although this is very unlikely. Brady's actual father remains unknown to this day. Without spousal support from a partner and with little in the way of family to help, Peggy struggled to care for her newborn son. As a result, she would end up giving him up for adoption. Brady would end up being raised, still in Glasgow, by a local couple named Mary and John Sloane. The Sloanes already had four children of their own, and young Ian completed their family. Upon joining the Sloane family, Brady would also take on their surname, becoming Ian Duncan Sloane. Throughout his childhood, Ian's birth mother continued to visit him regularly, so he always knew that he was an adopted member of the Sloane family. Records from Brady's childhood suggest that he had behavioural problems and he would quickly enter a life of petty crime. Years later, while in prison, Brady described his childhood as an idyllic one, surrounded by a loving family and lots of friends. The truth, however, was far from this. Brady was a loner and didn't have any friends. He was distant with his adoptive family and was a disruptive child. But then, a lot of what Brady would write and describe from prison was carefully calculated fiction. It's important to note that Brady was never abused as a child and was never involved in arson. He was also never involved in acts of violence towards animals, all of which are common hallmarks of a developing murderous psyche. Dr. Chris Crowley interviewed Brady for his book Face to Face with Evil, Conversations with Ian Brady. During those interviews, Brady stated that as a child during the Second World War, he explored a bombed-out church in the Gorbals area of Glasgow. He came across a small bird living in the ruins. Brady stated, "I quietly approached him to avoid alarming him, near enough to see it was apparently breathing and asleep. I reached out to hold it. Suddenly something subconscious froze my movement. As I stood and watched its breast rise and fall, I identified the sweet smell of petrescence and gingerly touched the bird with my shoe. It was a vessel of seething maggots, my first lesson in the deception of nature in life. Disgust gave way to pity, and I built a tomb around it with bricks. I assumed that gave rise to the stereotypical fable that I once buried a cat alive." Even though he didn't, many tabloid newspapers report and still state that Brady killed animals in his youth, maybe trying to fit him into the stereotype to ease their unanswered questions and fear. They also reported that Brady set classmates on fire, although it is not known where this rumor came from. Brady certainly denied it, and no witnesses or victims have ever come forward regarding any such incident. At the age of 9, Brady, along with his family, took a trip to Loch Lomond, where he discovered the freedom of the outdoors, something that would become a permanent passion of his. Brady's family moved to a new council house in a newly developed housing estate in Pollock, Glasgow, when he was around 10 years old. Shortly after, he enrolled at Shawlands Academy. Shawlands was a high school for gifted children, something which Brady was very much one of. Brady's behaviour nosedived as a teenager, however, and all of his progress in academia was wasted. At the age of just 15, Brady dropped out of school after he was twice arrested for burglary and appearing before the juvenile courts. He got a job briefly at the Heartland and Wolf shipyard in Govan, Glasgow. It was nothing special, just a T-boy role which Brady hated. He then switched this up fairly quickly and became a butcher's messenger boy. Brady thought he was above all these jobs though, an arrogance and ego which would stay with him throughout life. Brady's behavioural and minor crimes continued. He was placed in a remand home and later arrested for another minor offence and was placed on probation. Brady had 9 criminal charges against him when he would appear in court this time around. Following sentencing, he was set probation conditions that he must reside with his biological mother, who had now relocated to Manchester in England. Brady's mother had married an Irish fruit merchant named Pat Eric Brady, and after joining his mother and Pat Brady, would soon adopt his stepfather's surname. Brady got on well with his stepfather. Pat even arranged a job for Brady as a fruit porter in Smithfield's Market. Again, though, Brady felt above this job. It wouldn't be long, though, before Brady slipped back into his petty crime habits, and less than a year after arriving in Manchester, Brady was caught stealing a large bag of lead embossment seals. For all of his intelligence, Brady was not a very successful criminal, irrespective of what he thought of himself. The theft led to Brady being sent to Strangeways, a Category A prison in Manchester. He served at Her Majesty's pleasure for a period of 3 months. This period was what Brady referred to as his, and I quote, "short, sharp shock." Brady went on, "Strangeways opened my eyes, so I opened library books." Following his 3 month stint in Strangeways, Brady was sent to Latchmere House in Richmond-upon-Thames in London. This was what used to be known in the United Kingdom as a borstal, now more commonly referred to as a youth detention centre. During the Second World War, Latchmere House was used to house German prisoners of war, so how apt that Brady spent time there. Brady was moved around several other units over the next 2 year period in places such as Hull and West Yorkshire, but he was eventually able to return home to Manchester in 1957. Brady took up a manual labouring job, but quickly discovered that, guess what, He hated it. So no surprises there. He was also dismissed as an employee at a local brewery in quick, short succession. Brady acknowledged that he was lost, aimlessly treading the boards of life, and he was keen to take control, to better himself. He began to collect books in order to upskill, educate, and become better. He initially gathered a set of bookkeeping instruction manuals, which he would study alone in his room for hours upon hours. He appeared to enjoy learning and studying viewpoints that he may have never examined before reading about them. He also focused on a series of books called Teach Yourself German, which were a means to an end, as he wanted to learn the language so that he could read and understand Adolf Hitler's autobiography, Mein Kampf. As well as Mein Kampf, there were also several other tomes referencing the Nazi atrocities of the Second World War and prior, which Brady had an interest in. He used books to build a world of his own and engrossed himself in his passions. In January of 1959, Brady applied for a job at Millwood's Wholesale Chemical Distribution Company. The job was local, in the area of Gorton, Greater Manchester. He landed the role and dove right in, committing himself to executing the role to a high standard. Colleagues stated that he was quiet but punctual and had a short temper. In January 1961, Millwood's employed a new typist, 18-year-old Myra Hindley. Hindley was born in July 1942 in the Manchester suburb of Crumpsall to Nellie and Bob Hindley. Her parents, Nellie and Bob, raised her in Gorton, a small working-class area of the city, known for old Victorian housing and being generally run down at the time. Hindley's father was a violent alcoholic, and along with the family's lack of wealth, it gave way to a childhood of abuse, poverty, and difficulty. Their family home was in a terrible condition, and Hindley often slept in a single bed next to her parents' bed. When her sister Maureen was born in April 1946, things declined and tensions grew even worse. The family couldn't continue to look after both children, nor did they have the room for both, so Myra was sent to live with her grandmother when she was just 5 years old. When Myra was 8 years old, a local boy attacked her and scratched her cheeks, causing bleeding. She burst into tears and ran to her father for sympathy and support. But he only retorted with a threat that if she didn't retaliate against the boy who hurt her, then he would hurt her even worse. This would cause a change in Myra, and she did as her father told. She beat and kicked the boy, never being afraid to defend herself again. Malcolm McCormack, professor of forensic psychiatry here at Cardiff University, stated that her relationship with her father brutalized her. He added that she was not only used to violence in the home, but rewarded for it outside. She became acclimatized and desensitized to violence. Her father's abuse made her apathetic to brutality. From a psychological perspective, we know that when this happens at a young age, it distorts an individual's reaction to such situations for life. Another point of trauma for young Myra occurred when she was just 15 years old. Michael Higgins, one of her closest friends, invited her to go swimming with a group of mutual friends at a local water reservoir. Sadly, a day that was meant to be fun and joyous turned into a living nightmare when Michael drowned in the reservoir. His funeral had a huge and lasting effect on Myra. Held at St. Francis's Monastery in Gorton Lane, the same place where Myra was baptized as a child, the whole experience shook Myra, and the trauma stayed with her throughout her entire life. As Myra grew older, she attended Ryder Brough Secondary Modern High School. After Michael's funeral, Myra became fascinated with death and would study subjects that would make others turn away in disgust, such as injured animals or humans. Her fascination with the macabre was firmly established. While it's possible her morbid interest developed on the back of Michael's demise, friends of hers from a young age have stated this interest was there long before Michael's death. A school friend of hers recalled she had no empathy for anyone else. If somebody hurt themselves, it wouldn't upset her or affect her in any way. She was a cool, calm, cold, and calculated bitch. According to Crime and Investigation, at some point during her teen years, her father suffered a stroke and became cruder and nastier towards her mother. As a result, an infuriated Myra would attack and humiliate him in the same way that he had done to her as a child. Myra took up judo lessons around the age of 17. It revealed more of her cold side, and she displayed just how tough she was. Other class members were reluctant to partner with her or tackle her. She was cruel and would often take the fight too far, going on after the instructor had called to stop. After she finished school, Myra held a number of entry-level jobs around the same period, and she even considered following in her father's footsteps by joining the army or the navy, and even thought about leaving the country altogether and heading across the Atlantic to the United States. Instead, she opted to pick up a mundane clerical position in her hometown of Gorton. In January of 1961, Myra began working at Millwoods as a typist. Despite being aware of his criminal record and background, she became attracted to Brady almost immediately. She appeared to enjoy his sophistication and his arrogance, and that he was unlike any other men that she'd ever met. Shortly after she began working at Millwoods, she began to keep a diary in which Myra essentially tracks her obsession with Brady. She spoke to him for the first time on July the 27th of 1961. Then, to her surprise, on December 22nd of the same year, Brady asked Myra out to the movies. During the subsequent dates which followed, the pair went to the cinema, often to see an X-rated movie, then returned to his home to drink German wine, which was a lavish drink at the time for two working-class individuals in England. Myra was still living with her grandmother at the time. Brady began to give her books to read, and on their lunch breaks, they would read out loud to one another from tomes about Nazi cruelty. Brady was conditioning Myra into his frame of mind. Myra, in her infatuation, was happy to be conditioned. It didn't take much effort from Brady. Over the subsequent few months, Myra began to transform herself into the ideal Aryan woman, bleaching her hair, platinum blonde, and wearing deep red lipstick. She became surly and secretive. She also began to dress differently, favoring short skirts, high boots, and leather jackets, becoming a version of herself that no one around her recognized. Myra was by now a far cry from the mild-mannered, shy girl who started at Millwoods. She had molded herself into Brady's dream woman, but things weren't so glittering and gleaming beyond the surface. Myra was concerned about some of Brady's behaviors. In a letter Myra wrote to a childhood friend, she documented the time when he drugged her and sexually abused her while she was unconscious. Myra hung on every word that Brady spun her, though. She would state that, and I quote, "Within months of our relationship beginning, he had convinced me that there was no God at all. He could have told me that the earth was flat. The moon was made of green cheese and the sun rose in the west, and I would have believed him. Such was his power of persuasion." Some early reports from the press stated that the couple's crimes were the result of her being brainwashed by Brady. And an aura of lies and urban legends in some parts still perpetuate this myth. But don't be drawn in by these theories. Yes, Myra was infatuated by Brady, but her scruples, mind and behaviors were already there and entirely her own. Brady was the fuel, Myra was the match. In the months after they began dating, both Brady and Myra became a lot less sociable and outgoing. They frequented the library, taking out more books on crime, torture, and philosophy, as well as reading works by Friedrich Nietzsche and the Marquis de Sade. Yes, the French nobleman who wrote about violent and cruel sexual fantasies, and also the words of Dostoevsky. They frequently discussed the idea of plans to rob banks and raid jewelry stores, and Brady even arranged for Hindley to obtain a driver's license so she could be the getaway driver. Their plots and plans, however, never came to fruition. Brady also purposefully befriended the president of the Cheadle Rifle Club, George Clitheroe, and on several occasions they would visit the shooting ranges in Stockport together. Clitheroe was very puzzled by Myra's interest in guns. She certainly didn't seem to fit the average visitor to the range, or most with an interest in firearms that he knew. That aside, however, he was happy to arrange for Mary to purchase a .22 caliber rifle from a gun merchant. She also asked to join the pistol club, although her application was rejected because she was a poor shot, and often bad-tempered along with it. Still, she managed to secure two more guns from club members, including a Webley 45 and a Smith & Wesson .38. In addition to their passion for guns, Brady and Myra bonded over their love of photography. Brady already owned a Box Brownie camera, which he used to capture images of Myra's dog Puppet. He soon upgraded to a more advanced model camera to use for more and more ambitious projects, and also purchased darkroom gear and lighting equipment. Brady soon joined Myra and her grandmother and moved into their home in Bannock Street. But in the summer of 1963, the couple's relationship and lives would change forever. Brady began to talk about the perfect murder. He often spoke to Myra about the 1956 book Compulsion, written by Maya Levin. The book is a fictionalized version of the crime committed by Leopold and Loeb in Chicago in 1924. I have briefly discussed Leopold and Loeb in a previous episode in passing for those who remembers that, although I have not dedicated an episode to their crimes or gone into the details of what they did. But Leopold and Loeb were two wealthy university students who kidnapped and murdered 14-year-old Bobby Franks in Chicago in May of 1924. They felt their plot would show their intellectual superiority, which enabled them to carry out the so-called perfect crime without consequences. It was widely considered that the crime of the century at the time that it occurred. Both men, however, Leopold and Loeb, ended up being caught and sentenced to life in prison plus 99 years. Loeb was murdered in prison by an inmate in 1936, while Leopold was released on parole in 1958 and would eventually die in 1971. At the time that Brady and Myra were reading about the pair, Leopold was very much still alive, well, and a free man. Brady was obsessed with committing the perfect murder. Myra was obsessed with pleasing Brady. The murders. On July 12, 1963, having spoken about Brady's desire for the perfect murder, the couple made a plan of action. Brady instructed Myra to hire a van, and she drove it around the streets of Manchester with Brady on his Triumph Tiger Cub motorbike, trailing behind and looking for his ideal victim. When he spotted one, Brady told Myra he would flash his headlights as a signal for her to pull over in the van. The couple drove down Gorton Lane, and Brady signaled Myra. He spotted an 8-year-old girl walking alone. But Myra recognized the child as a neighbor of her mother's, and so they kept driving. Sometime just after 7:30 p.m., however, they spotted 16-year-old Pauline Reed as she walked down Froxmoor Street. She was on her way to a local dance. Again, Myra knew the girl. She was a friend of her younger sister Maureen's, but Myra didn't know her well enough to abort their plan. Myra slowed the van and pulled up beside Pauline. She asked Pauline if she wanted a ride, and the teenager accepted. Now, in the van and hidden from eyes, Myra asked Pauline if she would first help her look for expensive gloves that she'd lost on Saddleworth Moor, just a short drive away. The teenager, once again, placing her trust in the older woman, agreed. Myra would later make conflicting statements about who really picked out the victim in this instance, but also stated that she felt there would be less attention regarding the disappearance of a 16-year-old than there would an 8-year-old. Pauline actually recognized Myra as being the older sister of her classmate Maureen. That put her at ease and lent trust to the situation. Pauline and Myra arrived on the moor, and Brady pulled up behind them shortly after. Brady reassured Pauline that he was also there helping them both to look for the gloves. A few short minutes went by where the three searched on the moors for gloves that didn't actually exist. Then, Brady guided the teenager to follow him into a hidden and secluded spot deeper on the moor. Myra climbed into the driver's seat of the van and watched the events unfold before her. He returned alone after 30 minutes and took his girlfriend to the spot where Pauline lay naked and dying, her clothes strewn and in disarray. The wounds to her throat included a 4-inch incision across her voice box, which had almost decapitated Pauline. The injury had been inflicted with considerable force and malice. Her necklace and the corner of her coat had been pushed into the throat wound. When Myra asked Brady if he had raped Pauline, he replied with, "Of course I did." Following Pauline's murder, Myra waited with the body for Brady, who went to retrieve a shovel that he'd stashed nearby on one of the couple's previous trips to the area. Brady then buried the body while Myra returned to the van. Myra would later deny being actively involved in the rape and murder of Pauline. Brady would argue that she most certainly participated in the sexual assault too, however. Shortly after Pauline went missing, a police investigation was launched. At the time, it made little progress. Nobody had seen Pauline around the time of her disappearance. She had seemingly vanished into thin air. Pauline's boyfriend, 15-year-old David Smith, was initially a prime suspect in the case. Smith had a number of past criminal convictions, including actual bodily harm and housebreaking. Smith's first crime was wounding with intent, which occurred when he was just 11 years old. So to the police, they almost certainly had their man, or boy even, in this case. However, David was later cleared of involvement following the provision of an alibi, although police still kept one close eye on Smith. Brady, who knew the drama and circus that surrounded Pauline's disappearance, laid low following the murder. But on the evening of November the 23rd, just 5 months after they abducted Pauline Reed, Brady and Myra struck again. Their taste for blood had been acquired and its habit was formed. They spotted 12-year-old John Kilbride at a market in the town of Ashton-under-Lyme. A slightly different setup from before, Myra had rented a Ford Anglia this time, and Brady accompanied her in the same vehicle. Myra pulled up alongside John and offered him a lift home. Myra told him that his parents might worry that he was out too late. Myra also promised him a bottle of sherry if he got in the car. John happily obliged and got in. Once inside the Anglia, Brady said that they would need to take John towards their home on Bannock Street to collect the sherry. As they got closer to this location, however, Brady then suggested another detour. Brady again brought up a story of the expensive gloves belonging to Myra that were lost on the moors. Brady asked John if he would help Myra and him look for the glove, something which John was more than happy to help with. Once the group arrived at Saddleworth Moor, Brady took John and headed off to a quiet, isolated spot away from Myra. While she waited in the vehicle, brazenly smoking a cigarette, Brady sexually assaulted John, exposing him to horrific and tortuous sexual acts. Once Brady was finished, he attempted to slit John's throat with a 6-inch serrated blade that he was carrying. John, however, put up too much of a fight. He struggled, and in the pandemonium of the moment, Brady strangled John with either a piece of string or a shoelace. Following John's disappearance, an extensive search for him was launched. More than 700 statements were taken from the public by the police, and 500 missing persons posters were printed and issued throughout the city of Manchester alone. 8 days after John had vanished, more than 2,000 volunteers searched derelict buildings, wasteland, and vacant lots looking for the missing boy. Myra hired a van on the morning of December the 21st, around a month after John's disappearance, to make sure that the burial sites of both he and Pauline had not been disturbed. The couple's third victim was 12-year-old Keith Bennett, who Brady and Myra abducted in the early evening of June the 16th, 1964. Myra asked Keith for his help with lifting some boxes into another rented vehicle, telling him that she would drive him home afterwards. The young boy had been walking to his grandmother's house in Longsight, a small inner-city suburb of Manchester. Keith agreed to help Myra, and afterwards they agreed Myra would drive him to the mall. Brady, who was in the back of the van, took Keith to look for Myra's lost glove on the moors. Like the previous murders, Brady returned to Myra alone 30 minutes after arriving on the moors, clutching a shovel. He brazenly told Myra that he had sexually assaulted and strangled Keith using a piece of string. The investigation into Keith's disappearance, like the others before them, was relatively short-lived. Keith's stepfather, Jimmy Johnson, was initially a suspect, and police submitted him to intense questioning four times over the course of the following 2 years. Detectives also searched beneath the floorboards of the family home looking for Keith's remains there, but discovered nothing of importance to the case. The police did, however, identify that all the houses were connected beneath the floorboards by a street-long crawl space. This led detectives to then scour the entire street for the missing 12-year-old, but their attempts to locate him were fruitless. On August the 15th, just 2 months after the disappearance of Keith Bennett, Myra's sister Maureen married David Smith, her partner. Smith had been dating Pauline Reed at the time of her disappearance. The couple's marriage was swiftly arranged and took place at a registration office. Maureen was already 7 months pregnant, something that was looked down upon at the time, so the wedding needed to be completed as soon as possible. The Hindleys did not attend the ceremony, as they, including Myra, did not approve of the marriage, with Myra and Maureen's mother deeply ashamed that Maureen had gotten pregnant outside of wedlock. After the couple were married, they initially moved in with David's father. Just one day later, Brady suggested that David and the two sisters go with him to Windsor for the day, a 414-mile round trip. This was David's first time meeting Ian properly, and they seemed to hit it off. Brady was impressed with David's demeanour. While David paid for Ian's food and drinks during the trip, while they discussed society, socialism, and the possibility of robbing a bank. It would be the first of many group trips that the two couples took together, and while Myra became closer to Maureen, she also became weary and somewhat jealous of David's relationship with Brady. Shortly afterwards, Brady, Hindley, and her grandmother were rehoused by Manchester City Council as part of the post-war slum clearance in Manchester, and they moved into a new home at 16 Wardlebrook Avenue in a newly built estate in Hattersley, which was then part of the County of Cheshire, though now forms part of Greater Manchester. Here, the couple became friendly with an 11-year-old girl who lived nearby, by the name of Patricia Hodges. She would regularly accompany the couple on their trips to Saddleworth Moor, where they collected peat soil together. The collection of peat soil was fairly common occurrence for people living on the newly built estate at the time, because the existing garden soil was full of clay and builder's rubble. Thus the peat soil from the moors helped to improve the garden soil. Patricia was never harmed by the couple during their killing spree. This was likely because she lived nearby and was known by many neighbours to spend time with Brady and Hindley, which would make it easy for the police to link her disappearance back to the couple if anything should happen to her. On December the 26th, 1964, the couple went out to look for their next victim. An 11-year-old girl named Leslie Ann Downey was found by Brady and Hindley alone at a fun fair in Ancoats, an area of Manchester. The couple approached the young girl and purposefully dropped their bag of groceries in front of her, asking for her help in picking it up and taking it to the car. From there, they asked if she would accompany them to their home and help them inside with their groceries. Earlier that day, Hindley had taken her grandmother to a relative's home and convinced her to stay for the night, refusing to let her back into her own residence and craftily manipulating her. At their home in Wardlebrook Avenue, Brady and Hindley stripped, gagged, and forcibly posed young Leslie for photographs before she was sexually assaulted and murdered. Leslie cried and begged for her mother as Brady and Hindley humiliated, degraded, and ravaged the child. Brady was recording the encounter on a tape, which the police later described as the most harrowing and shocking 16 minutes of audio that they had ever heard. A number of police officers broke down and cried at hearing the tape. Both Brady and Hindley showed no compassion or sympathy for young Leslie, and they did not hesitate or pause, even for a second, as they carried out their horrific attack. The next morning, the couple took the little girl's body to the moors and buried her in a shallow grave. Despite an extensive search for her by the police, no trace of Leslie was found in the following months. The day after her demise, Hindley's grandmother returned back to the property unaware of what had occurred there the night before. By February of 1965, Patricia Hodges had stopped visiting, but the couple remained close with Hindley's sister and brother-in-law, Maureen and David. In fact, David regularly visited the pair at Wardlebrook Avenue, and he maintained a good relationship with Brady, who gave him books to read and discussed murder, robbery, and other crimes with him. Around the time of Hindley's 23rd birthday, in the summer of 1965, Maureen and David were rehoused to a block of flats at Underwood Court, which was very close to Wardlebrook Avenue, just across the street. As a result, the two couples became even closer and would spend even more time together, although all time spent together was generally on Brady's terms. Hindley and Brady's final victim was 17-year-old Edward Evans, who perished on October the 6th, 1965. Hindley drove Brady to the Manchester Central Railway Station where he could scout out a victim. Brady emerged from the station with Edward, an apprentice engineer from the Manchester district of Ardwick, and introduced him to Hindley, who he said was his sister. Brady would later claim that he had picked Edward up for a consensual sexual encounter. Edward was a shy and lonely boy. He had no friends or social life, and the offer of company from Brady was more than appealing to him. He and Hindley drove Edward home, and they shared a bottle of wine together. Brady drugged Hindley's grandmother with a sleeping pill in her drink so she wouldn't stir through the next part of the evening. Later in the evening, Brady sent Hindley to fetch David, who by now was 17 years old. Hindley, despite being concerned about Brady and David's relationship, as she felt it would compromise the couple's safety, did as she was told and returned with her brother-in-law in tow. Brady, on the other hand, wanted to implicate Smith in what was about to happen. He wanted to draw him into his crime so that he would become part of things. David, when later speaking with the police, commented the following. I waited about a minute or two. Then suddenly I heard a hell of a scream. It sounded like a woman, really high-pitched. Then the screams carried on one after the other, really loud. Then I heard Myra shout, David, help him! When I ran in, I just stood inside the living room and saw a young lad who was lying with his head and shoulders on the couch and his legs were on the floor. He was facing upwards. Ian was standing over him, facing him with his legs on either side of the young lad's legs. The lad was still screaming. Ian had a hatchet in his hand. He was holding it above his head, and then he hit the lad on the left side of his head with a hatchet. I heard the blow. It was a terribly hard blow. It sounded horrible. Afterwards, David watched as Brady strangled Edward to death with a length of electrical cord. During the struggle, Brady sprained his ankle, and Edward's body was too heavy for David to carry alone. So they wrapped him in plastic and placed him in the spare room on the promise that David would return the next day with his baby's pram, which they would use to place the body on so they could move it to the car and dispose of it in the moors. But David would never keep his promise. Following the murder, David returned home. It was around 3 a.m. when he arrived back at his flat, and his wife Maureen offered to make him a cup of tea as she could see that he was shaken. David drank the tea and then vomited. He then told Maureen what he had witnessed that night at his sister's house. David, scared and anxious, waited up until daylight broke. He felt that if he left, Brady or Hindley would see him, so he wanted to wait until daylight and until there were people on the streets. At 6:10 a.m., he left his house with Maureen to go to a phone box around the corner from his flat. Smith was carrying a hammer and Maureen a screwdriver to protect themselves in case of attack. David called the local police station and told them of the events of the previous night. He demanded the police pick him up from the phone box and take him to the police station right away. Superintendent Bob Talbot of Stalybridge Police Division went to Hindley's residence in the company of a detective sergeant. The police officers weren't sure how the inhabitants of Wardlebrook Avenue would react when they knocked their door, even if they would answer the door at all. So they donned long white coats and milkman's hats, which they borrowed from a passing delivery driver. This disguise worked. When they knocked on 16 Wardlebrook Avenue, the door opened calmly. It was Hindley. The police asked Hindley if her husband was home. She replied that she had no husband, and then let the officer into the living room, where Brady was laying on the couch, writing to his employer about his ankle injury. Superintendent Talbot explained that he was investigating an act of violence involving guns which had occurred one night earlier and needed to look around the premises. The police asked Hindley to allow them access to their spare bedroom, which was locked at the time, and she claimed that the key was at her workplace. When the officers offered to go and collect the key, Brady told her to just hand the key over to the police. So she did. When the officers accessed the room and saw the body of Edward Evans, they immediately arrested Brady on suspicion of murder. Brady argued that Eddie and him had a row and the situation simply got out of hand. The police officers, however, didn't believe him and they took Brady in for interrogation. Brady claimed that he and Edward had got into a fight and that he and David had killed Edward together. He also stated that Hindley had only done what she had been told by him. Hindley, meanwhile, was not arrested right away. However, she demanded that she be allowed to go with Brady to the police station and brought her dog Puppet with her. She refused to make any statement about Edward's death beyond claiming that it had just been an accident, and she was allowed to go home later that day on the condition that she returned to the police station the following morning. During the next 4 days, Hindley visited Millwoods and asked to be dismissed by the company, so that she could collect unemployment benefits. While at Millwoods, she found an envelope belonging to Brady, which he burned in an ashtray. She later claimed that she didn't open it, but believed it contained plans for committing a bank robbery. On October the 11th, Hindley was arrested and taken into custody. She was charged as an accessory to the murder of Edward Evans. She was remanded at Her Majesty's Prison, Risley in Warrington. Investigators first began to suspect that the couple had more than one victim when they began searching their house on Wardlebrook Avenue and came across a notebook containing the name John Kilbride. They turned their attention back to David, who told them that Brady had asked for anything back that may incriminate him, including the numerous books on controversial topics like murder and torture. He then packed the items into a suitcase. David, however, had no idea where Brady had taken the suitcases afterwards, although he noted that his brother-in-law had a thing about railway stations. On October the 15th, the authorities headed to the railway station and discovered that the lost luggage office had suitcases belonging to Brady. It was a complete off-chance and discovery by luck. They had found the claim ticket inside his prayer book. Inside one case, they discovered 9 pornographic photographs of Leslie Ann Downey, as well as a 16-minute audio tape recording of the girl screaming, crying and begging to be allowed to go home to her mother. Both Hindley and Brady's voices were also clearly audible on the tape. While looking for further information on Hindley and Brady, law enforcement officers came across their neighbour Patricia Hodges, who was by now 12 years old. She told them that she'd been taken to Saddleworth Moor on several occasions by the couple, and she was able to point out the couple's favourite areas to the authorities. This helped them narrow down the locations where they felt they should look for evidence, and on the 16th of October, the police discovered an arm bone protruding from the ground. It was originally believed to be John Kilbride, but it was in fact Leslie Ann Downey's. Her body was still identifiable, and her mother recognised her clothing, which had been bundled in her grave at her feet. Searching further through Brady's suitcases, police officers also uncovered images of certain locations on the moors. The authorities guessed that the photographs held significance to Brady and Hindley's crimes, an assumption that turned out to be true. David Smith told the police that his brother-in-law had posed for photographic proof of several slayings. So investigators believed that these photos were of burial grounds, and they asked for help from locals familiar with the land in identifying the spots in the photographs. The locations, it was soon discovered, were around the Holland Brown Knoll area of Saddleworth Moor. On October the 21st, authorities found the body of 12-year-old John Kilbride. That same day, Hindley and Brady appeared at Hyde Magistrates Court. They were both charged with Leslie's demise and brought into the courtroom separately from one another. They were both remanded in custody for a week. 7 days later, they each made a two-minute appearance in court once again, and once more were remanded into custody. Meanwhile, investigators suspected that the couple were involved in more than three disappearances, but searches were called off following the discovery of John Kilbride's remains, since it was almost November and the weather conditions were worsening on the moors. When confronted with the existence of the photographs of Leslie Downey, Brady said he took the images but that she had been brought to his house and taken away again by two unidentified men. He claimed the 10-year-old was alive when the men took her away. By December the 2nd, Brady had been charged with the murder of John, Leslie and Edward. Hindley was charged with the murders of Leslie and Edward and as an accessory to murder in the case of John Kilbride. At the committal hearing, the murder charges remained the same for both parties, though Hindley was not charged with accessory to murder. Instead, she was charged with harbouring Brady with knowledge that he killed John. Over an 11-day period, the proceedings continued before three magistrates. By the end of the hearing, the pair were committed, ready for trial at Chester Assizes. In the lead-up to the trial, the police decided that Puppet, Hindley's dog, should be examined so that they could ascertain the dog's age. As many of the photos taken on the moors featured Puppet, sometimes as a puppy, they found that knowledge of the dog's age would help them determine when the images were actually taken. However, Puppet was put under general anaesthetic for the examination, and he did not reawaken. Hindley was furious and accused the police of murdering her dog. Investigators noted that it was the first time they had seen her truly upset. In a letter to her mother, Hindley wrote about her heartbreak over her deceased pet. She wrote, "I feel as though my heart's been torn to pieces. I don't think anything could hurt me more than this, as the only consolation is that someone might have got hold of Puppet and hurt him." The trial began on April 19, 1966, and would last for 14 days. Security screens were fitted to protect Brady and Hindley in the courtroom, and they were both defended by experienced attorneys. Emlyn Hooson QC was Brady's defense, while Hindley was defended by Jeffrey Heilburn QC. Attorney General Sir Elwin Jones led the prosecution, assisted by William Mars Jones. Justice Fenton Atkinson ruled over the trial. David Smith was the prosecution's key witness. Shortly before the trial took place, David sold his story to the News of the World newspaper for the moderate equivalent of £20,000, with an agreement that he would be paid more in the future. He was paid an additional £15 a week up until the trial, and a £1,000 lump sum if Hindley and Brady were both found guilty. While David was questioned about his deal by the judge and the defence, it was decided by the judge that the money had not substantially affected his testimony. It remained the same as the initial statements that he had given to the police. So, although Judge Atkinson ruled the newspaper's action as gross interference with the case and of justice overall, it was allowed to proceed. Both Hindley and Brady entered pleas of not guilty, while Brady testified for around 8 hours. Hindley testified for six. During the trial, Brady admitted he struck Edward with an axe, but he claimed that someone else had killed him, noting that the pathologist concluded Edward's death was accelerated by strangulation. This caused the jury to see Brady as an arrogant and pedantic individual. Hindley, for her part, denied knowing that the images found in the suitcase had been taken at or near the graves of the couple's victims. When confronted with the audio tape featuring her voice along with Brady's and Leslie's, Hindley admitted that her attitude towards the 10-year-old had been brusque and cruel, but claimed it was only because she was afraid the child screaming would attract attention. Hindley then claimed that when Leslie was undressed, she went downstairs. When the pictures were being taken of her, she was looking out of the window. And when Leslie was being strangled, Hindley said she was running a bath. Neither Brady nor Hindley would admit that it was Leslie's voice on the tape, so the police had to ask her mother to identify it, forcing her mother to listen to her daughter's last tormented and hellish moments alive. On May the 6th, 1966, the jury deliberated for a little over 2 hours before concluding that both Brady and Hindley were guilty on all charges. Since the death penalty had been abolished, they were both sentenced to life behind bars for each murder. Brady would have to serve 3 life sentences, while Hindley would serve 2 plus 7 years for harbouring Brady in the knowledge that he had murdered John Kilbride. Brady was thus sent to His Majesty's Prison, Durham, a Category B men's prison to fulfil his sentence, while Hindley was sent to His Majesty's Prison, Holloway, an establishment for women and young offenders located in London, which is now closed. At the end of their trial, Justice Fenton Atkinson described them both as two sadistic killers of the utmost depravity and recommended that they spend a very long time in prison before even being considered for parole. He saw no possibility of Brady being rehabilitated, but felt Hindley would have a chance when she was out from under the thumb of her boyfriend, stating that, "I believe Brady is wicked beyond belief, without hope of redemption. I cannot feel the same is necessary true of Hindley, however, once she is removed from his influence." She was later described as a quiet, controlled, impassive witness who lied remorselessly. Following their convictions, the media continued to try and link Hindley and Brady to other disappearances and unsolved murders in Manchester and the surrounding areas. The newspapers suggested that the murderous couple were responsible for the disappearance of Stephen Jennings, a 3-year-old boy who vanished from West Yorkshire in December of 1962. His body was discovered in a field in 1988, and his own father was ultimately convicted of the crime. The media became even more suspicious when in 2004, a rumour spread that Hindley had confessed to the murder of a 6th victim, a teenage girl, she said. This caused the press to suspect that the girl in question was 14-year-old Jennifer Teague, who vanished from a children's home in Oldham in the winter of 1964. This story was eventually laid to rest after Manchester police announced that Jennifer Teague was found alive and well. This was all documented in the book Myra Hindley, Inside the Mind of a Murderess, by a close friend of Hindley's called Jean Ritchie. In 1985, Brady told journalist Fred Harrison that he had also killed Pauline Reed and Keith Bennett. The police had already suspected this because both children had lived near the couple and had vanished around the same time as the other crimes had taken place. In return, Brady wanted to be moved to a secure hospital, and he also wanted to make sure that Hindley would never ever get out of prison. As a result of this confession, the Greater Manchester Police reopened the investigation, and it was led by Detective Chief Superintendent Peter Topping. Topping's first move was to visit Brady, who was then residing in Gartree Prison in Leicestershire, on July the 3rd, 1985. Brady toyed with the police and was scornful of any suggestion that he had confessed to Harrison or of any more murders. It was not a surprise to anybody that Brady refused to cooperate. He was an emotional, cruel and bitter man who showed no remorse to what he had done to any of his victims. Still, the police began a fresh search of Saddleworth Moor for any further bodies that were as yet undiscovered. Over a year later, in November of 1986, Winnie Johnson, the mother of Keith Bennett, wrote a letter to Myra Hindley in HMP Cookham Wood in Kent, where she was then residing. Johnson begged to know the truth about what happened to her son and pleaded with Hindley to know where his body was buried. Upon reading the letter, Hindley was reportedly genuinely moved. Part of Johnson's letter read as so: "I'm a simple woman. I work in the kitchens of Christie's Hospital. It has taken me 5 weeks labour to write this letter because it is so important to me that it's understood by you. For what it is, a plea for help. Please, Miss Hindley, help me." A few days later, Topping decided to visit Hindley, who was by now 64 years old. She refused to admit her involvement in the killings, but agreed to try and help identify the spots that she'd visited with Brady. Topping was quite cynical of Hindley's motivations to help the authorities. He believed that she was concerned her former partner might cooperate with the police first and win public favour. Still, it was agreed that a visit to the moors with Hindley would be valuable and outweighed the risk that somebody may target her while she was out of prison. So on December the 16th, 1986, she visited the moors with a substantial police escort. The road into the moors was closed off and the area was patrolled by around 200 officers carrying automatic weapons. The area was locked down extremely tight and a media circus erupted. Hindley, while at the moors, had difficulty connecting the areas of the moor to her memories and was unable to provide the police with any useful information, leading to the media labelling the situation as a fiasco, a publicity stunt and a mindless waste of taxpayers' money. David Smith, who was now 38, and also brought in to help identify areas of the moor worth investigating, also had trouble. He spent 4 hours doing so. Meanwhile, Topping continued to visit Hindley in prison. On February the 10th, 1987, Hindley formally confessed to her involvement in all 5 killings. Topping, however, was not impressed by it. He noted that he was struck by the fact that in his tally she was never there when the killing took place. She was in the car, over the brow of the hill, in the bathroom, and even in the case of Edward Evans's murder, in the kitchen. He also added that he felt he had witnessed a great performance rather than a genuine confession from her. Following her admission, the police visited Brady once again, who did not believe it when they told him that Hindley had confessed to all the murders. It wasn't until they told him a few details about Pauline Reed's death that he realized that they were telling the truth. Brady told them that he too will confess, as long as they provided him with a means of taking his own life afterwards. Of course, the police refused, and so Brady declined to admit to anything. After a second letter from Winnie Johnson, Hindley made another attempt at helping the police by visiting the moors for a second time since her incarceration. The levels of security were greatly increased even more this time around. While she was unable to specifically locate the graves of Keith and Pauline, she indicated that the 2 areas in which the police were searching, Holland Brown Knoll and Hoegrain, were in fact correct. On July the 1st, 1987, authorities finally uncovered the remains of Pauline Reed based on information that Hindley had given to them. Following this discovery, Brady made a formal confession to DC Topping. Brady too made a trip to the moors with police guard, but he quickly became lost on the moor and was removed from the scene due to the press who had gathered in the area. He was not given another chance to help investigators, and the search for Keith's body was called off on August the 24th. Brady thrived and relished the attention he received from the press. He wrote a letter to a news reporter working for the BBC claiming that he killed 5 more people, including 2 people in Scotland and a woman whose body he dumped in a canal. But the police were never able to find any evidence of these crimes or reports of dead bodies that matched what he described. So an official investigation was never launched. Hindley made it clear that she was not connected with and had no knowledge of these crimes if they had truly taken place. Neither party was convicted further for the additional murders of Pauline Reed or Keith Bennett, since they were already serving life behind bars. Throughout the early and mid-2000s, searches were conducted again by the police in the hope of finding Keith Bennett's body once and for all, but to this day it has never been located. In 2012, there was speculation that Brady had given a female visitor the location of the body, and she was subsequently arrested on suspicion of preventing the burial of a body without a lawful excuse. However, the Crown Prosecution Service announced that there was insufficient evidence to press charges, and the case was dropped. Furthermore, in 2017, the authorities requested the 2 locked briefcases owned by Brady be forced open. Police hoped the cases may contain clues to Keith's whereabouts. However, this request was denied on the grounds that no prosecution was likely to occur. In His Majesty's Prison Durham, Brady asked to live in solitary confinement. He spent 19 years in prison until November of 1985, when he was diagnosed as a psychopath and subsequently moved to Ashworth Mental Hospital in Merseyside, a high-security hospital for prisoners. He reportedly made it clear that he never wanted to be released, and nobody, including judges and home secretaries, disagreed with his notion. Throughout his time at Ashworth Hospital, he refused to cooperate with his psychiatrist. He sometimes wrote to journalists and novelists and once claimed that he and Hindley planned to stop murdering after 1964. They had, according to him, been plotting to carry out armed robberies instead, and he began to obtain weapons for this very reason. Brady also told Dr. Crowley, the head psychiatrist at Ashworth Hospital, that he hated Ashworth, and he whined about the conditions of the hospital incessantly. In 1999, his wrist was broken, and he blamed it on the staff. He subsequently went on hunger strike and was force-fed, later being moved to another hospital before recovering. He claimed the hospital had no right to force-feed him, and later stated the following: "Myra gets the potentially fatal brain condition, whilst I have to fight simply to die. I've had enough. I want nothing. My objective is to die and release myself from this once and for all. So you see, my death strike is rational and pragmatic. I'm only sorry I didn't do it decades ago. I am eager to leave this cesspit in a coffin." Dr. Crowley claimed that Brady regretted getting caught, but not regretted the murders themselves. He reportedly saw no point in making a public apology, but tried to express remorse through actions instead. He spent his time incarcerated transcribing classical text into Braille, and once offered to donate his kidneys to somebody, anyone who needed one, but he was prevented from doing so. Writer Colin Wilson, whom Brady exchanged letters with, claimed it was because these attempts to express remorse were thrown back at him that he began to contemplate suicide. A female friend sent Brady 50 paracetamol pills inside a hollowed-out book in 2006, but the tablets were intercepted by authorities. Still, many of Brady's actions behind bars show a man who had no remorse and wished only to inflict pain upon others. In 2005, Brady wrote a letter to Winnie Johnson, claiming that he could take police to her son's body, but they would not allow it. He reportedly referred to Keith by his name in the letter. Hindley, for her part, logged an unsuccessful appeal against her conviction immediately after the trial. She exchanged letters with Brady after they were imprisoned until 1971, when she ended their relationship. She continued to correspond with him several months afterwards, but letters between the two became few and far between. According to Hindley, she'd fallen in love with a prison warden named Patricia Cairns. Later, Hindley petitioned to have her status as a Category A prisoner changed to a Category B prisoner, which was granted. This allowed her to be able to take an escorted walk outside, although the press despised that one of the most famous child killers in the country was allowed such freedoms. At one point, she attempted to escape from prison with the help of Patricia Cairns. Copies of the prison keys that Cairns had made were intercepted by an off-duty police officer, and Cairns was sentenced to 6 years in prison for her part in the scheme. In 1977, the BBC produced a programme which debated Hindley's future. It featured two teams, one who argued for Hindley to be released, and the other who argued against her release. Originally, it was agreed that she would spend 25 years in jail before being considered for parole. But in 1985, the Home Secretary increased that number to 30. The outcome of the BBC vote was heavily in favour of her never being released. By this time, the serial killer claimed that she was a reformed Catholic. Leslie Downey's mother was the face of a campaign that campaigned to ensure that Hindley was never released. After Hindley confessed to the five murders, Home Secretary David Weddington imposed a whole life tariff on her, although she was not made aware of this until 4 years later, in 1994. In 1996, the parole board suggested Hindley be moved to an open prison, but she rejected this idea. 2 years later, she was moved to Her Majesty's Prison High Point, a medium security facility. Hindley made three appeals for freedom between 1987 and 2000, but each one was rejected by the courts. During her time in prison, she learned to play the guitar, took up knitting, and obtained a degree from the Open University. She also earned an award for a song that she had written and recorded. During the 1990s, Hindley claimed that she had participated in the murders because Brady had drugged her and was blackmailing her with pornographic images, and he had threatened to kill her sister Maureen if she didn't go along with him. She told her solicitor around this time that she should have been hanged. She deserved it, she said. She also, at this time, considered herself to be worse than Brady regarding the crimes. For a period in the late 1990s, Myra Hindley was in a brief relationship with fellow serial killer Rose West. The two high-profile murderers were inseparable for an 18-month period. However, the relationship eventually soured after the two argued over who was the most famous, and they never spoke again. On November 15, 2002, Hindley, at the age of 60, died from bronchial pneumonia at West Suffolk Hospital. She had previously been diagnosed with angina and hospitalized after suffering a brain aneurysm in 1999. A short service was held following her death at Cambridge Crematorium. None of her relatives attended. Around 20 local undertakers refused to handle her cremation. Ultimately, her ashes were scattered in Stalybridge Country Park in the spring the following year by Patricia Cairns. In 2012, Brady went on another hunger strike wishing to end his own life. He died of restrictive pulmonary disease at Ashworth Hospital on May 15, 2017, age 79. An inquest found that he had died of natural causes, not from his hunger strike. He was cremated without a ceremony and his ashes disposed of at sea, although he allegedly wished for them to be scattered across Saddleworth Moor, much to the fury of the general public and the family of his victims. Ian Brady and Myra Hindley were not just responsible for the horrific sexual assaults and slayings of five children and for inflicting internal pain on the families of their victims, but for causing lasting damage to the people around them. David Smith, following the trial, became reviled by the people of Manchester because he profited from the murders. Maureen, who was 8 months pregnant at the time of the Brady and Hindley trial, was attacked near to where she lived with David. Their home was frequently vandalized and they regularly received hate mail. Maureen later stated that she could not and was afraid to let her children out of her sight as they were growing up. David spent some time in prison after stabbing a man during a fight in 1969. He was behind bars for 3 years, and he and Maureen's children were taken into care. Maureen, meanwhile, moved out of their shared home and into a single-bedroom property. She began working in a department store, but continued to suffer as campaigns and petitions against her gained traction. She received no support from her family, as their mother supported Myra during the trial. After David left prison, age 24, he moved in with a 15-year-old girl who became his second wife. He was also able to gain custody of his three children. He and Maureen divorced in 1973, and she went on to marry a lorry driver with whom she had a daughter. Maureen eventually made up with her mother, and they visited Hindley in prison on numerous occasions. Sadly, Maureen died in 1980 from a brain hemorrhage. At Maureen's funeral, the father of John Kilbride attempted to attack the daughter of Maureen's husband from his previous marriage. He mistook her for Hindley. Winnie Johnson, the mother of Keith Bennett, continued to visit Saddleworth Moor looking for any signs of her son's body until her sad death in August of 2012. In 1987, the local council decided to demolish Brady and Hindley's home on Wardlebrook Avenue due to excessive media interest and vandalism, creating unpleasantness for the local residents. Notably, although Brady was the one sexually assaulting the children and holding the murder weapon, Hindley took much of the blame and the brunt of the hatred from the general public, which was not helped by a constant attempt to gain freedom on her part, or the fact that she waited around 20 years before confessing to her involvement in the crimes. For many people at the time, her participation in such brutal and cruel acts of violence was a shock to the system. Even today, people have difficulty with the concept of a woman being aggressive and committing horrendous crimes, especially toward children. Author Helen Birch described Hindley as synonymous with the idea of feminine evil. What motivated Hindley? Whether she truly was threatened and blackmailed by Brady, or whether it was because she wanted to feed her own sinister urges, we will likely never know. Similarly, how involved she was with the crimes will continue to remain unclear. We only really have her word for how much she participated, which changed on numerous times over the years. Brady, meanwhile, appears to display the traits of most serial killers: a distinct lack of guilt, a twisted need to turn his victims, and a desire for power and notoriety. The evil of Myra Hindley and Ian Brady is still felt today, and while they confessed to 5 murders, many people believe that there are countless more victims waiting to be found.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.